baby. Stop. Right on.
Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Calvin. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, Earl. We made it to Friday.
Yeah, we did, man. We did. And then since we made it to Friday, my co-host Sandy Williams is in the studio sitting straight erect.
And he made it to Friday, too.
Well, we had a great walk yesterday, man.
Yeah, we did. Oh, yeah, Calvin, I'm 6'3". I heard the speculation about how tall I might be. I know I look like Ichabod Crane. No, I'm tall and thin, it's not that tall.
No, listen.
We had a great walk. You know, walking around Milwaukee, there's so many great neighborhoods to walk and look at, and I have friends who come to town. They're always remarking about how there's different all the houses are different. You know, the architecture of the old homes was unique and different. And, you know, there was a lot of pride expended in the 20s and 30s in the homes that were built in old Milwaukee.
You know, Sandy, we walked 9 miles. And for all of you who thought I couldn't make it, we walked 9 miles, and it didn't even appear to be that, because we were walking through beautiful, breathtaking Lake Park.
Yeah, Lake Park, and the homes that are around Lake Park, and you look at it, and your mind goes to the history of, like, all these places were built in the 20s. What was Milwaukee like in the 20s? And I always find myself trying to take myself back in time to try and feel like what it must have felt like in the Milwaukee of the 20s. It was the boomtown of America. My dad moved here from Utah in 1928, so to take part in this boomtown, and his college roommate, who was from Oklahoma, moved here too, because everyone was, all sorts of young people were moving from all over the country to Milwaukee. It was a bit like the San Francisco east of, or Stuttgart is probably what it was more like.
Sandy, the fact that you're like a historian and you could tell me about the houses and all of that is what makes it so interesting, right? You what would you say in the 20s the architecture was like? I mean, those.
Well, there were like four or five outstanding architects in Milwaukee at the time who were designing homes, and most of them were sort of neoclassical homes. They were copying the style of homes in various parts of Europe, some of them German, some of them Mediterranean, many of them English in style.
Right. And the other part of it was, you said Milwaukee was the 10th largest city in the United States.
Well, it was the 10th largest city in the United States in 1953, I remember that clearly, because there was always a sort of an argument between Pittsburgh and Milwaukee as to which was 10th or 11th, and that's why we got the Milwaukee. That's why the Boston Braves and the Major League Baseball allowed them to move to Milwaukee, because Milwaukee was the largest metropolitan area in the country without a Major League Baseball team.
You know, and you know, we're going to move on, but I think this part of the history of it, people.
Well, the thing is, we're like, what are we, 25th or 26th? And if you look at the list, almost every city that has passed us in size since we were 10th or 11th is south of the Mason-Dixon line and has grown basically as the result of commercial air conditioning turning into residential air conditioning. Almost every one of the cities that has passed us in size is in the Sun Belt.
So, well, then that says that most of the people were moving because of the weather. It's hard to compete with 65 degrees in December.
Well, I mean, that the United States population drift has been to the Sun Belt. So, you know, what I'm describing is not news to anybody,
right,
but it's so happens.
Well, it's news to some, because I had a guy call the other day and we were talking about why Milwaukee's population has dwindled so much. And, you know, and I tried to explain to them that over the 30 years or whatever it was because of our loss of industry and weather and taxes.
Well, and actually, interestingly, the Milwaukee metro area has grown. And the city of Milwaukee, which is, you know, just this municipal boundary, has shrunk. But the metro area has grown because of sprawl. So a big reason that Milwaukee has shrunk is not that they're leaving Wisconsin. It's just that many people who would otherwise have resided within the city of Milwaukee are residing in the urban sprawl of metropolitan Milwaukee.
So Sandy, we have to talk about what's happening in Maui in Hawaii. And what can you say other than the city has been incinerated?
Yeah. I've only been to Hawaii twice, but I spent time in Maui. And Lahaina was this beautiful old whaling town. It was one of the only old parts of Hawaii because it was the original capital of the Kingdom of Hawaii, and it was this whaling center from the mid-early 1800s. And apparently it is just gone. And, you know, the fact is that, as I was saying to you off there, I don't remember in the first 50 years of my life reading about wildfires very often at all. And now we read about them. I mean, they're consuming Canada. They just consumed an island, the island of Maui. They're ongoing in California every year. There are huge wildfires taking not thousands but millions of acres of land. You know, there's clearly something going on and that's causing us to have these disturbances in what used to be our ecosystem. Some of it might be, I mean, some of the wildfires are apparently attributable to man, things we have done to the forest that to make it much more flammable. But some of it is just, you know, you have to scratch your head and say, what's going on? Why is this happening? And it has to do, I guess, with extremes in wind, extremes in weather.
Well, they said 80 mile an hour winds.
Yeah.
And that area was completely bone dry, had not received.
Well, Hawaii's and Maui in particular has got like four ecosystems, and if you're there's a volcanic mountain on Maui, and one side of that mountain it's tropical, on the other side of the mountain it's desert, just because all the rainfall drops on the lee side of the mountain. So, I think that Maui, much of it is bone dry. Typically.
Yeah, but, and it's been that way forever, but they didn't have this fire until now. Let me ask you, Sandy, because again, there's this continued debate about whether global warming is real and all the things that we see, Sandy, point that something is going on, and we should be cognizant of that, right? I mean, we shouldn't say it's not happening. Shouldn't we be doing everything within our power, Sandy, that we can to at least attempt to?
Well, you know, I don't think there's much debate anymore about whether global warming is happening. I think the people who are on the other side of the debate who want to fight against changing our behaviors to contend with global warming take the position that the global warming is happening based on these inexorable influences on the globe, you know, that this would be happening anyway, independent from man's contribution. And I think scientists, on the other hand, most of them say, no, yeah, there might be a trend here, but what's happening now, and when you look at human conduct and the change in the CO2 in the atmosphere, what have you, we have, whether this is a trend that would be occurring over millions of years, we have accelerated the trend to the point where now what's happening is in many respects attributable to our conduct. So that's the nature of the debate. It's not, is it happening? It's like, what's causing it to happen? And then scientists are saying, yeah, but what's causing it to happen is accelerating its occurrence, and we could decelerate that potentially by changing human behavior.
All right, Lou from Cudahy. Good morning, Lou.
Good morning. I was just reading something on one of my informed conservative news resources, and there's a college in Florida called New College of Florida. Its board has eliminated the college's diversity, equity, and inclusion office and banned the use of diversity statements. I think academia is on the decline. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say this, Lou. I think academia is certainly under assault. I'm not sure it's on decline. I do think that you know, we had a caller a couple of days ago who called in and was talking about how upset he was with Democrats, and then he was going to vote for Trump even though he didn't like Trump. He said he was getting more enthusiastic because he thought Trump was the only guy that could beat these Democrats. And I said, what is it about the Democrats that you don't like? And he reached, we didn't get a chance to finish the conversation because of a break, but he said, you know, look at the women's soccer team. They won't even sing the national anthem. And somehow that was the response to the view of Democrats. And, you know, I'm not sure all those women are Democrats. They might be liberal, but they're not operating under any sort of government fiat with respect to their conduct. And I would say the same about academia. You know, the academia isn't operating based on government influence so very much, and it's operating as it always has. And academia, there's always been a split between conservatives and academia. Academia has almost always been viewed as sort of liberal, and off and on have always been called liberal elite in the process. So it seems like they continue to be positioned in that same way. And we seem to be attacking academia now for things that only little parts of academia might be participating in, you know, critical race theory and what's being taught in some schools, in some places, and mostly in graduate schools. And it seems to have inflamed the public about education more generally. So, I definitely think academia is under assault. Do I think it's in decline? I hope not. I mean, academia is where we learn things,
and
right?
Is it a good thing that it's under assault? I don't think so.
Well, I think it's always been a problem, the sort of attacks on academia. Academia is a place of freedoms, right? A freedom of expression, freedom of thought. There has been a problem in some schools where maybe correctness has become overwhelming, but typically universities, even the liberal ones, defend the right to have conservative expression carried out there. I went to a very liberal university, and we could talk about any and all things and learned any and all things at the school.
All right, we got to go to a break. Thank you for the call, Lou. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show, Fridays with Sandy Williams, my co-host. We'll be right back.
Vodka. Come brunch it up over bottomless mimosas or a midday pick-me-up or with the whole family for an unforgettable Sunday brunch. Brunch it up in Milwaukee, Brookfield, or Cedarburg from 7 to 3 on weekdays and 8 to 3 on weekends. Let's brunch it up.
You are never far away from your favorite local radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app, and we invite you to get social with us by following our network's Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook pages. Want even more? CivicMedia.us.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Scattered thunderstorms likely today. Otherwise,
welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, what is going on with the Supreme Courts? On the state level, on the national level, something is happening. Those were the areas that we used to feel comfortable. Well, I mean, when I was a young man, yeah. You know, the people who are on the Supreme Court, state or United States Supreme Court, those people we just said they were the best of us.
Well, I think that ethics has declined generally. I think it's declined generally. I think people from the U.S. Senate go to Washington with low net worths and they come out with high net worths. Same is true with Congress. And these people kind of feather their nests. I think it used to be that if you were in politics, but particularly if you were a judge, you were going to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. You weren't going to worry about the fine edge of the law of ethics. You were to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. And that was clearly an ethic that was required of judges. And how could anyone think that these trips that not just Clarence Thomas, but the other Supreme Court justices take at the, financed by other folks, could have anything but an appearance of impropriety? I mean, anyone knows in business, if you're in business and someone, let's say you're in the hospital business, you're a doctor, and someone from Pfizer comes to you and says, how would you like to go on a yacht trip, my good friend? You're my good friend. I see you every week when I come to the hospital. And Pfizer would like to host you on a wonderful trip to Bimini on a private yacht. Now, if you took that trip, you would know, absolutely know, that you were doing something you shouldn't be doing. And it wouldn't even be a question. So, is there an appearance of impropriety about that? Absolutely. And so, Clarence Thomas, I guess, 38 luxury trips that he's accepted from as gifts. But it's not just Clarence Thomas. I mean, it's the other justices as well. I mean, the ones that have at least accepted gifts from third parties. If Ruth Bader was taking luxury vacations with her husband on her husband's financed by her husband and his income, that's a different story than accepting a luxury trip from somebody.
Well, and you're talking now, Sandy, 38 and counting.
Yeah.
For one man. Clarence Thomas, if he had any self-respect, he's been there a long time. Wouldn't you think he would say, okay,
Well, and the same is true, actually, of the justices of state courts and the Supreme Court who take speaking fees to go speak at highly partisan events,
right?
Which is happening more and more. Does that have the appearance of impropriety? Well, absolutely. If you take a large speaking fee and you go speak to a body that is highly partisan, that has ideological views that will be considered by the Supreme Court in all kinds of ways. So, I mean, I don't think you have to stop being a human being. You certainly don't have to stop voting if you're a judge. But being a judge and having a life appointment, there's a downside to it, which is now you've got to live your life like Solomon's wife. You've got to be above reproach. And that's where we've begun to fall short. The same is true in the U.S. Senate. If you become a U.S. senator, you've got a high station in life. The downside is you need to live your life above reproach.
Sandy, to me, correct me if I'm wrong, the more you see these things, the more you start questioning our government.
Well, you become cynical.
Yes.
Which is what our public has become, right? I mean, half of the Trump movement is based on basic cynicism about government generally and an attack on government because people have become so cynical about it, they'd rather sweep it out, take the baby out with the bathwater. The problem is we haven't figured out what we're going to replace it with. What we ought to be doing is fixing the things that are eroding our confidence. We ought to be erecting ethics standards. We ought to be getting money out of politics. Half of the reason we're so cynical about it is that we all, like Tom from California, realize that there's a great deal of money in politics that's calling the dance. So it's hard not to be cynical about a system that operates that way.
Sandy, the problem is we, the people, have put trust all this time, and we actually feel like there's nothing we can do about this.
Well, part of that is this money in politics, because there's nothing there's nothing we do that seems to be responded to because government is so busily responding to special interests and not responding to us.
So speaking of that, when we come back, Sandy, Purdue Pharma, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court blocking a deal that has been kind of almost consummated.
Right, the settlement.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the fact that the Supreme Court is now getting...
Conversation had sounded out to you.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. And Sandy, the billionaire Sackler family, is, you know, these are the people who own Purdue Pharma and the opioid crisis that is the number one killer, Sandy, now.
Opioids.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's not something you want your name attached to. Is it safe to say that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. The $6 billion settlement that now the Justice Department is intervening and asking the Supreme Court to defer, to stay the court in terms of its hand, in terms of approving the settlement, because of the fact, apparently, that it's come to light that the Sackler family, in advance of the settlement, had withdrawn from the company in the neighborhood of, I think, $12 billion that they could move into the family coffers, out of the corporate coffers, and therefore make it beyond reach of the creditors being all these people who were suing Purdue Pharma about the opioid crisis. You know, it's in bankruptcies, we call these fraudulent transfers, where you get money out of a corporation that might otherwise be targeted by the creditors and get it into the hands of the owners of the corporation so they can walk away from a corporate bankruptcy with some money in their pockets. Same deal. This was basically Purdue Pharma's owners getting money out of the corporation so that they could walk away with a bunch of money in their pockets if the obligations from all this litigation were to render Purdue Pharma valueless, bankrupt, or at least much less value. And so that's what this is about, you know. And so I guess the Supreme Court, the Justice Department wants a court to consider whether $6 billion is an adequate settlement when there was $12 billion that left the company and went into the pockets. I think the number is $12 billion.
Right.
That left the company's coffers and went into the pockets of the owners and was therefore beyond the reach of the litigants. And the settlement said that the Sackler family would be immune from litigation with the payment of the $6 billion out of Purdue Pharma's coffers. And so that's what this is about, whether that $12 billion that walked away from the company and into the Sackler pockets should be actually reachable by by those who want to sue the Sacklers over this whole opioid problem.
So Sandy, on the other side of it is, this has been in the courts now for 4 years, and some are saying, hey, let's just take the $6 billion. Families are hurting. You know, these resources can be used now. People need this money now, and we don't want the Supreme Court to interfere. But that's not how it works.
Well, it's not necessarily how it works, and it might be a little short-sighted on the part of plaintiffs generally. I mean, my view is that the number $6 billion isn't going to go down. It's only going to go up as the result of not approving the settlement in light of the circumstances. I'm not privy to all the details here. I'm not privy to exactly how the $12 billion was moved out of the corporation. But, this is a longstanding kind of a problem in many litigations that relate to pursuit of money out of corporations, and that is this fraudulent transfer issue. Now, I'm not sure they're calling this transfer, were these transfers fraudulent transfers, but they clearly are going to attack the notion that the money was transferred out of the company in order to put it beyond the reach of the creditors who would be suing it, creditors being the plaintiffs who were pursuing Purdue.
So Purdue Pharma clearly does more than opioids. They clearly have other...
They had other drugs, but I think the history of Purdue Pharma is that OxyContin, I think, was the drug. But when they hit gold, the first gusher they hit was opioids, and they then rode the opioid horse to a lot of money and a lot of profits.
Oh, so when they talk about restructuring Purdue Pharma, They're talking about without OxyContin, probably, right?
And restructuring usually means a reorganization, taking products, separating out the products that are made from and creating a valuable corporation out of what's left in a restructuring.
Can a company with that's tied to something like oxycodone and all these deaths, can they? You know, resurrect themselves.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Corporate restructuring is done all the time. So
yeah, but these are a lot of people who died.
Well, I know, but they restructured a variety of companies in the asbestos industry. You know, it's ongoing, and it's just something that is done by credit lawyers and bankruptcy courts. And the effort is to try and keep a business going that's employing people, right? I mean, businesses employ lots of people. It's not necessarily a good thing to have businesses go down the tubes altogether. If you can salvage the good part of the business and keep it in business, that's what capitalism wants to have accomplished. It's also what all the workers in those that occupy those jobs would like to see happen.
You know, Sandy, I want to move to President Biden asked Congress for $40 billion to support Ukraine, replenish U.S. disaster aid, and bolster the border. The border it's not going away. So Sandy, your thoughts on that? Why can't we fix that? Why can't Democrats and Republicans both come together and say, hey, let's stop playing this game. New York can't continue. And all the places where they move these people, you know, Sandy, it's not ending.
Well, my question is, for particularly with respect to disaster funding and the border, why wasn't it in the budget in the first place?
Right.
You know, why do we need to go in now and seek a surcharge, essentially, a new appropriation for it? And similarly,
you mean for disaster relief?
For disaster relief, you know, normally those kind of things are funded like an insurance policy, right? You keep funding them, even, and you excessively fund them in years when there aren't disasters.
Because you know they're going to come.
And you dip into those funds because that's what insurance is all about.
Right.
If you fund them on an ongoing basis, it's a little bit different, and you can have real, real big upswings and downswings and expenditures and more volatility. You know, my questions about all of them is that, you know, is it, we don't really have a bottomless pit in terms of money. And for instance, the ongoing, I think it was $13 billion was the number asked now for Ukraine and additional funding. And it keeps coming every month. And I think the issue is going to be whether our Congress continues to believe that Ukraine is of such strategic importance to the United States that we will continue to fund it at these extraordinary levels, because it is very extraordinary. You know, when you start totaling up the number, we're going to get to $200 billion in the space of a foreseeable future in terms of the amount of money that we might have sent off in that direction. It was over $100 billion some little while ago. We haven't yet run an audit, and we do know that Ukraine remains a corrupt place. Zelensky, apparently, as you informed me this morning, just this morning, I guess, announced the firing of a whole bunch of people associated with their military and their drafting into the military because of corruption, because of money that wasn't getting to where it was supposed to get.
You know, Sandy, it really does make you pause and again question why these things are tied together. Now, you know, the disaster relief, as you stated, should have nothing to do with money.
Well, disaster relief, either we're going to fund it, like I said, like an insurance, or we're simply going to self-fund ourselves on an experience basis and view the country as a big enough risk pool so that it kind of evens out year after year. And that would be okay, too. So, but we shouldn't be worrying too much about disaster funding.
Right.
You know, that's something.
Because we have to have that.
We have to have it as a country, and I guess we have to be careful about exactly what we declare a disaster, and we shouldn't maybe be restoring floodplain areas to the position where they can continue to have homes there.
Florida.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so that you continue to create claimants for the next flood that you know is going to happen. So, you know, we need to be smart about our disaster money, but yeah, you know, that shouldn't be a matter of much dispute in terms of funding for that.
But this then, Sandy, creates the things that many of us, the average American citizen, does not understand about our government, the complexities of it, where things are intertwined that should not be intertwined. There should be no question that the money going to Ukraine being tied into disaster relief, I would say no way in the world those two things should even be mentioned in the same breath. But that's how our government works, right? I mean, that's
sure,
how...
Yeah, I mean, you try to slip in things that might be controversial with something that's an absolute requirement and tie them together and get people to vote on it. Sure, that's what's going on here. You know, but my view of the whole situation is we've got all these things that are happening. We've got disasters like Lahaina and Maui, and we've got Ukraine where we're sending money without much debate. And meanwhile, we aren't solving our domestic problems. We aren't solving our health care system.
Right, right.
We aren't solving daycare. We aren't solving the problems of Tom, Dick, and Mary. None of these things are focused on Tom, Dick, and Mary. And to me, that's the problem. And that's the problem with our current political process, too. Are we talking about Tom, Dick, and Mary when we talk about Donald Trump and the Republican nomination? No. And so, you know, we just have trouble getting our country to focus on the problems of the people of America.
So let's, and before we go to break, I want to focus even more on Ukraine and what is transpiring there, because you projected over a year ago our commitment. What is going to be our commitment on these airways, U.S.?
Yeah,
what is going to be our commitment before we got this heavily involved?
My point was sort of the Henry Kissinger real politics thing. Do we have a real strategic interest in Ukraine such that we will open our pocketbook willingly, because we all know that it's so important to us that we will do any and all things to defend Ukraine? And the fact was that we that isn't our position. And it's why we haven't got Ukraine in NATO, because we know that we wouldn't abide by Article 5 or wouldn't want to abide by Article 5 if Ukraine stubbed its toe with Russia down the road. It's why we don't and shouldn't let Ukraine into NATO now, because it would commit us to putting boots on the ground and fighting over Ukraine. It's just an area of suspect about our real strategic interest.
All right, hold the thought, Sandy. Got to go to a break. Tom, we'll come to you on the other side. Tune into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday. Fridays with my co-host, Sandy Williams. We'll be back. Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. My co-host Sandy Williams is here. Let's go to the phone lines. And Tom from L.A., good morning to you, Tom. You say what?
Yeah, first off, Earl, we the people ultimately are the government, and we must never forget that. But right now, of course, with money and politics, it doesn't seem like we are the government. It's corporations that basically are running the government. Sandy talks about the issues of the day, which I totally agree with him in terms of child care, mortgage, health care, and taxes. But we don't talk about those things at all because the billionaires have us fighting each other over other issues like Donald Trump every single day. That's because of lobbyists. That's because of lobbyists, and that's because of money and politics. I do want to say the Republicans in power are the Antichrist. They just are. They show it every single day. And they make people not want to actually even call themselves Christians. So the other thing I want to say is that the Sackler family, I don't see this as a good thing that the Supreme Court is stopping this thing right now, because I think that there's a way that Purdue Pharma is going to get out of this, which I'd recommend everyone watch the movie Dope Sick or the series Dope Sick on Hulu, because you'll see all about the Sackler family and the whole OxyContin issue that happened. That's all I got today, Earl, but I find it interesting that all of a sudden the Republican callers that are calling in, I can always tell what's going on right-wing media for people like CJ and stuff, because I don't have to watch it, one. But I can always tell because it kind of goes in a cycle. Like, I haven't heard them talk very much about immigration lately. So I'm sure that that's not what they're talking about. Or I can always tell when they're talking about Hunter Biden, because all of a sudden that's what they're talking about. It's really amazing how it is that the propaganda that is in this country has just taken people that are probably very, very smart people, like Gary and Dave and TJ and people like this, but they just really are being bamboozled, and they're being, just suckers for, supporting Donald Trump.
Hey.
And supporting the Republican Party. Thank you.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for the call, as always. Hey, Sandy, let me get back to Ukraine and where this thing is headed. You talked about quagmires. We just got out of that 20 years with Afghanistan, and I don't know, 15, 17, 18 with Iraq. You're not looking for this thing to end soon, and you said that Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with our foreign involvements is we seem to have a rationale for getting in, but we don't have an endgame analysis. We don't have a strategic interest. When we don't have a real strategic interest someplace, we end up carrying out essentially military adventures, whether directly or indirectly, that don't have an end game. And without an end game, we end up in quagmires. We end up in places. For instance, this war between Russia and Ukraine has a long history behind it. And there's a long history behind the people involved in it. And our critical strategic interest in Ukraine is not at the same level as our critical strategic interest in many other parts of the world. And yet we decided, I think, on sort of a knee-jerk Cold Warrior kind of a basis that we were going to be against whatever Russia's interest was, and we were going to introduce ourselves into this geography which Russia would claim to be its area of hegemony, right? The old USSR area,
right?
Which clearly is an area of Russian hegemony. At the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia was definitely not just on its knees, it was crawling for probably a decade. But it has clearly resurrected itself in many ways, at least militarily. And it is, of course, the largest nuclear power in the world. And so it's a force to contend with. Similarly, China has now hegemony, which we need to understand and figure out the extent to which we're going to respect it. We exert our hegemony over the world. And so Ukraine, I believe, is going to be viewed as become more and more controversial in Congress because of the fact that our strategic interest in Ukraine is not clear and not apparent and was not clearly identified. We can talk ideologically about defending democracy, but beyond that, what is our, in fact, direct strategic interest in Ukraine? And you know, we have trouble painting that interest other than the interest we would have in any place in the world that has any kind of natural resources.
So forgive me if I'm using the wrong verbiage, but now that we've spoon-fed them, Ukraine, to get into this position where they are not going to be able to sustain any of this without us, we've kind of opened up a Pandora's box that...
Well, that was what we talked about at the beginning of the conflict, which was if this is not an area of real strategic interest to us, and if
we've hurt them.
And if that means we're going to pull out eventually or withdraw eventually our aid, then we have put them in the position of sacrificial lambs. We have put them into a world of danger by giving them the false belief that they could stand up to Russia.
Right.
They knew they couldn't stand up to Russia without a great deal of foreign assistance. Without the promise of that foreign assistance, they will have lost hundreds of thousands of men and women in this war and decimated their economy and decimated their infrastructure. And for what if in fact we aren't going to stay in it? And the fact is that I think it was very predictable that the extent of the appetite of the West to support Ukraine was finite, okay? And I suspect that Russia and Putin knew that as well, and they're holding on and testing it. Right now, the war in Ukraine is a quagmire that is fighting in a very limited geographic region where hundreds of thousands of people are dying in essentially a World War I style combat.
Hey, Sandy, and we aren't going to stay in it.
Well, I would be surprised if 5 years from now we continued to have an appetite.
Wow, you're talking 5 years.
Well, 3 years. I mean, this war could, at its current rate, this war is definitely going to go on. I'm confident that it's going to go on past the 2024 election, okay?
Wow. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.